Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. Got my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr., and we have an awesome obesity specialist physician with us, Dr. Leslie Golden, and she's going to be helping us talk about the insurance part of obesity medicine, because that's like the question we get all the time. But how can I afford this medicine? So welcome, Dr. Golden.
Thank you.
So let's just kind of dive in. Like, what are the big frustrations? I want to hear like about from what a patient says, and also like from a clinician standpoint, because we have our own frustrations in the background of dealing with insurance, and we have these like what I would call them slight, you know, miraculous drugs. These new drugs are just amazing. Again, do you make money from Big Pharma? Are you a Big Pharma show? No. See, no. Okay.
None of us yet.
None of it yet.
Not yet.
We talk about we could, but we don't. Okay.
To figure out how that happens.
You could talk. You can submit things, and they can go, oh yeah, we'd like you to be a speaker. You know, you're in Wisconsin.
They ask probably you and all of us to be speakers all the time, and I personally have to decline as we're working on like different guidelines and stuff for some of the organizations I'm involved with, and I don't know. Amazingly, I wouldn't mind doing educational speaking, and maybe I will someday, but then I'll have the conflict of interest. And so it's
So yeah, if you wanted to do it, you can actually sign up to be a speaker, and they would probably love to have you in your local area. If you wanted to, Eli Lilly, Novo Nordisk, again, we don't make money from these people. We're friends with them.
But they have good medications.
They do. And so the big frustration
is getting them.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about it. I just want to hear what your journey is through this whole thing. And you've been doing obesity medicine for a few years now, and you are really passionate about this.
Yeah, of course. Deal with it every day. And it's true. We have these great medicines. They really help people that have been struggling for a long time, but access is the issue. And when you're physicians like us that are interacting with these patients on a daily basis, having to look them in the eye and say, I have this amazing medicine that could help you, but your insurance doesn't cover it, or they exclude it because it's a vanity drug, is a really difficult conversation to have each and every time. So I think it really creates quite the inequity for so many people. I mean, I can have one patient come in and I can just give them the drug that they need. They have the right insurance. I know here in Wisconsin, Medicaid covers the anti-obesity medicines.
Yeah. Same with Michigan. We're getting semaglutide. And so when we see some of our Michigan Medicaid patients who really are part of the population who really need and benefit from these medications, we're so excited.
Right.
And then there's this big chunk where we're stuck.
Right. And so I don't know how your state Medicaid regulations are. For us, we can start them, but there's a 1-year time period that they get. Then they have to come off of it for 6 months for a drug holiday.
Oh my gosh.
And to see if they can maintain their weight, because that's obesity works.
Wow.
No, not at all.
Oh,
wow.
I didn't know that. I don't think that's how Michigan Medicaid is. If it is, and if anybody listening who has any knowledge of this in Michigan or anybody who works for our Medicaid, please let me know, because if that's the case, then that's going to be a problem starting soon, because it's been about a year since they covered it.
Yeah. I'm actively trying to work with Wisconsin Medicaid to understand the disease process, because there's no science behind that, right? So they get it for a year. They have to do a drug holiday for 6 months to see if they can maintain their weight without the medicine. And then if they don't, they get it for one more year, but there's a 2-year lifetime maximum.
Oh boy.
And that's it.
So, as a physician who knows obesity medicine, it puts me in this place of, I mean, I could potentially do harm. I mean, yeah. if I could put you in a situation where you're losing a significant amount of weight because you have this hormonal control, and then I take it away, and I know everything you gain back is going to be 100% adipose tissue.
Psychological complications mm-hmm. of that as well. That mm-hmm. that's amazing. So I didn't know that. You know, and obviously that's a micro, not even a microcosm. That's a regular cosm. I don't even know that's a word, but of
that's a cosm.
That's a cosm of of the bigger insurance picture. Because then, you know, for example, we want to hear what you have to say. But in Michigan, yeah, so we have priority health, or not priority, but Medicaid, Michigan Medicaid, doing a good job. Then we have like our Blues, who do a pretty good job of coverage. They're kind of 50-50, specifically for, you know, we're talking about the more expensive GLPs and the GLP, mm-hmm. GIP someday. But then even they're 50-50, right? The Blues. And then we have a big chunk of insurances that absolutely do not whatsoever cover it. Now, that the specific insurance company I'm talking about that's big here, they do cover tirzepatide for type 2 diabetes, though. And so I was having this conversation with Spencer yesterday. I mean, that's before I start people on anything, you know, we do a full evaluation, but I do a lot of glycemic screening. So I do a ton of 2-hour glucose tolerance tests with an ironic sort of hope that maybe they meet criteria for type 2 diabetes. And they all know it. And unfortunately, what ultimately ends up happening is a lot of them who come to see us with obesity, history of gestational diabetes, PCOS, these mm-hmm. conditions where they have a little bit higher risk of prandial glycemic, you know, impaired glucose tolerance or metabolic syndrome and all these things, they end up having really, really, really high risk of type 2 diabetes, but it's all pre-diabetes metabolic syndrome, and they're on the cusp of having all these complications, but I still can't do it. And then they don't have the semaglutide right. covered.
Yeah. We have to wait.
It's amazing. They have to wait till the disease gets just a little bit worse, amazingly.
It's so stupid.
It is. Yeah. So what we see, I don't know if you're familiar with this or not. So some of the insurers, like the Blues, for instance, a lot of it is dependent on the employer mm-hmm. selecting a package or not. So, okay.
The thing called, they call a rider.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, obesity mm-hmm. rider. Mm-hmm. R-E-I-T-E-R. Right. Yeah. Did I spell that right? I might have just made that up. I don't know.
Yeah.
Actually, I thought it was a right, like a D. I didn't even know. I only ever hear the word. I've never seen it spelled out.
You guys keep talking. I gotta look this up. Obesity rider.
So, anyways, okay. So, you do that, Leslie. You keep talking while Spencer's looking this up to make sure we're not.
So we have two of our big regional insurers here completely exclude anti-obesity medications, which makes it difficult. And I've tried, I'll put the PAs in, I'll do the appeals, and it just doesn't matter what you say. They just, mm-hmm. no matter what, they're not going to cover it. Some of the ones where the employer hasn't added it on, since it's not considered an essential health benefit, mm-hmm. I will have the patient reach out to their HR department. I have a letter that I give them that written by me with the information informing their HR department how they could consider adding the coverage on. That's actually worked, I'd say, maybe about 30% of the time. But I really encourage the patients to really advocate for themselves, because I find that I'm the one calling the HR department, really trying to help and get them to understand and embrace this opportunity, and the patient's really hesitant to talk to them. And I think a lot of that is that internalized stigma, right? Like their employers already told them, their insurers already told them, we don't think you need help for this. And then they have to find the strength and confidence to call them and argue, yes, I do deserve help for this, just like any other chronic disease.
Wow. Yeah, it's ridiculous. It is rider. You're right. Like riding a...
Oh, so I was right. Because I was going to say, you popped on here. Now, people aren't watching this, but Spencer suddenly showed up waiting for Leslie to finish talking with a shitty grin. And I was like, okay, he found something.
No, I was laughing because I was... I swear I read that somewhere. I don't even know where... Because I was always like, rider. I don't... I thought it might have been writer, like a writer, but writer makes sense because it piggybacks on whatever. Yeah. Yeah, I was absolutely
the whole time,
wrong. Not even
the whole
close.
Time I'm like, Spencer's really liking what I'm saying, that smile on his face. Now he's like, stop talking so I can get my correction.
No, but what you're saying is so true because, like, okay, we do. So I'm with, you know, the sequence. We have so many members that, like, you know, a ton of them don't get coverage, and we wrote a letter that basically says, come on, like, obesity is a disease, can you bring this to your HR, we'll like talk to your like let's get this conversation going. And I like what you said is amazing, because it's like they already have this internalized stigma. There's the insurances, nobody's helping them out,
and they feel shame, you know, people make them feel shamed,
they got to go advocate,
it's not their
for themselves,
fault, it's their biology.
So we try to do everything we can to help them advocate, but like that's they really shouldn't have to. Yeah. This is ridiculous.
But so then here's the other part, and I don't know that any of us are experts to really dig into these details, but we can bitch and moan about it, is what is the root issue, right? So obviously there's the whole big pharma thing. They have the scientists, they've developed these really great medications, and there's a whole pipeline coming down the pike. And, you know, I was joking around with some of the cardiologists when I gave a talk a couple weeks ago up at a cardiology conference, because I was talking about these medications for obesity in cardiovascular patients. And they said, well, gosh, what are we going to do? We got to get these medications, but they're so expensive. So the cost is one big issue. And they're like, but it seems like almost everyone should be on it. And I said, you know, I'm not a drug shill. We just really aren't. I don't think everyone should just be on medications. But with all the people out there, you know, selling BS, you know, even talking about metformin as a longevity drug, and they're selling their supplements, it's like, if there was something that most people probably could benefit from, if it was dirt cheap, it would be these medications. I mean, can you imagine if they were dirt cheap and over the counter? I mean, there are pros and cons. There are still risks. They are still medications. But I would darn near consider being on that. And I wouldn't, and I've never taken any drug, and we're meatheads. We have never taken anabolic steroids or anything like that, but this would be the one I'd consider maybe taking it to, you know, because we all have some, you know, increased desires to have food intake, but the cost. So that's like a primary issue. Now the cost is not as bad in other countries. So this might get into some sort of political debate. I don't even know where I would fall on that debate.
But. Do you know about these costs in the other countries, Dr. Golden?
I mean, I know how much they are in like Canada and the UK, and it's significant, like 10-30% of what they are in the United States.
Yeah.
And so I've heard ridiculous. A few theories about the length of time for the patents being different in different countries. So
oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I hadn't heard that one before.
I never
so
heard
they
that
have,
one.
They have limited amount of time to make a profit off of it before it turns generic. So that influences it. And then I've also heard, of course, the theories, the offset of the cost due to like the UK having socialized medicine and those type of things. So
Well, I mean, and I tend to always blame big insurance. So I'm not anti big pharma. I'm also not pro big pharma per se. You know, people, you know, they have to be extreme one way or the other, right? So then they think we're either shills or we're like anti big pharma. It's like, okay, hold on.
Right.
Can we be reasonable? First of all, yeah, has big pharma caused some concern? Yes.
Yeah.
They're for profit. But do we want good scientific big pharma to be incentivized, and should they make money? Yes, I believe that too. But insurance drives me nuts. Mm-hmm. So it's a vicious cycle. Like some are not covering stuff, but then others are covering stuff, but then they just cover things willy nilly. And so this is where we even could debate, you know, Spencer and I may have slightly different views on this. Like there's a cost effectiveness. So if a medication is truly expensive, you know, and I will tell you, I consider these medications as they are because of their cost. They should be for those who have a little bit more severe disease of obesity, I think. Those who are at high risk of diabetes, high cardiovascular risk, a lot of weight that needs to come off for their other complications, et cetera, because of the cost effectiveness. You know, the NICE, you know, over in Europe, right? They did their cost effective analysis in the UK, and you know, and they're not cost effective. If you have high risk disease, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, metabolic syndrome, all the pre-diabetes, they're probably very cost effective. If you don't, they're not, but they're still indicated and appropriate for people if they were cheaper. And so there's this vicious cycle. I feel like insurance, you know, on the one hand works against us, on the other hand is almost too easy. And then it drives the cost up, or it allows pharma to keep their cost up because it's getting paid for a lot of people. You know, and Spencer mm-hmm. might have more insight into those data. And we had this discussion yesterday, and I don't know how I feel overall about it. I definitely feel like we have to be stewards of people's money that goes into insurance and taxpayer money. I mean, we all pay Medicaid taxes. So I don't necessarily think every single person who could get thousands of dollars worth of medication should be, if they don't truly, you know what I mean? We got to do a good job as clinicians helping people who really need it, get it. And those who maybe don't come up with other things and be cost effective. But the cost is, I guess, what I'm trying to complain about right now.
Yeah. I struggle a little, like I understand that the cost effective argument, but I struggle with it a little in other areas because, well, I'll give an example. So the times that I've been in the room with some of these insurance boards, they always go to how cost effective they are. You know, they're just too expensive. They don't see any cost savings when it's projected out. Too much of the population will need them.
Yeah, they have inappropriate timelines though when they do those. The insurance companies, mm-hmm. they're only looking 1-2 years out, right? They don't look far enough out to see the real cost effectiveness.
Mm-hmm. I think it's about 3 years, at least with the state employee. Yeah. Health board here, when they looked at it, they looked at a 3-year cost effectiveness mm-hmm. is what they wanted to see. But then they've also stated the adverse reactions, the cost of taking care of the adverse reactions. And every meeting I've been in, I feel like the adverse reactions, at least with my experience, are very exaggerated. You know, they'll comment on potential ED visits and hospitalizations due to the episodes of pancreatitis and vomiting. And
my heart is sinking because we literally have data to show that that's not the case.
Like, I know.
We have huge analyses showing that there is no pancreatitis really increased, a little bit of gallbladder stuff, and it's nominally significant and not, oh my God.
Because I was, for this instance, I was in a room a virtual room for an insurance board meeting where they're deciding whether or not they're going to do AOM. You know, there's a pharmacist presenting this information, and I raise my hand to debate this, and I'm told, Dr. Golden, I'm sorry, we don't take any public comment, but there's no clinician, there's no physician in the room, there's no, you know, MD, PhD in the room to argue this, and it's just being misrepresented. So that it was an experience I had. So the cost effectiveness and then also just really exaggerating. We don't know how safe these medications really are. It's never mentioned that, yes, I know there are different medications by trade name, but they don't talk about the evidence we have from them being used for diabetes. You know, we have much years of data because these medicines have been used for other reasons for a long time.
Wow.
So that's the part that I find frustrating with that. But then also in these same meetings, when they bring up this cost effectiveness, we'll throw back, well, does every medicine have to show that? You know, when we have medications that we're approving now for some of these new Alzheimer's drugs or things like that mm-hmm. get added to formularies, are we requiring cost effectiveness to be proven? It really seems to be criteria that is put on these obesity drugs. Because, you know, I used to and still do a lot of work with hospice on the side. And I mean, some of the palliative things that we do, it's not cost effective. Is all cancer treatment cost effective?
Right.
So it seems like an unfair piece of just a requirement that's put on the treatment of obesity that isn't put on other chronic diseases.
Stigma.
Bias and stigma.
What is the, that is extremely, it must be infuriating for you to be there. The cost thing, it's like, this wouldn't matter. Honestly, this wouldn't matter if they just made the drugs $50 or $100 cash. And then those who can't afford it, the insurance would kick in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why not? And that's the thing. And so as a globe, as clinicians, as people working in this space, you know, we got to find a way to get to this root cause. But that, you know, so we're talking about big pharma, we're talking about insurance. There's also pharmacies, right, that play some role into this. And then the whole PBM thing, that the middlemen, everyone's getting a piece of this pie.
For some reason.
Now, you know, so how I just don't understand those things and why people don't make a bigger deal about it. You know, we got in the politicians, they have their political arguments, but they don't ever seem to address what appears to be the obvious issues to us. Do they? I don't know.
No, I don't, because there's the Treat and Reduce Obesity Act that's been out there since, 2013, I believe. Yeah, it was first introduced and reintroduced every Congress. And I think this past year they had 175 co-sponsors. And for the first time ever, they sent it to the Congressional Budget Office to actually be scored. But unfortunately, of course, it came back saying that it would be a high-level cost piece of legislation. And so for people that don't know that are listening, the Treat and Reduce Obesity Act is proposed to expand coverage to Medicare beneficiaries of anti-obesity medications and behavioral intervention. So, but still not approved 10 years later.
The linchpin would be Big Pharma then, in my opinion.
So you're kind of blaming it on Big Pharma. I blame insurance and the PBMs and all these.
Hate insurance. I say cut them out. I say make it a high. I'm kind of more in this high deductible insurance for like catastrophic HSAs. Things. Make healthcare cheap.
But there are people who can't do that, right? So there's all these. It's complicated. I don't know.
Yeah,
and that's why it's hard to get into the politics of it, because I feel like the extremes don't communicate well and there's no compromise. But I like HSAs too. But there are obviously people who can't have that.
But make healthcare cheap in general. Make the doctor's visits not super expensive. Make these drugs not super expensive. And you know, of course, if you get hospitalized, that could be very expensive. You have a big hospital, you got lots of things taking care of you, but still they upcharge, you know, whatever it is that you hear about the Tylenol costs $1,000 or a couple grand. And that's insane to me. So like that needs to be shut out. So just make healthcare inexpensive, affordable, high deductible, can kick in for catastrophic things. The drug should be $50 to $100. Sure, I'm not sitting at their board and looking at it, but you see numbers of how much profit these insurance companies are making. They don't need more money. They're doing fine. Big pharma companies, they're doing fine. People need these medicines. They need to cut it. They need to make it.
Well, so here's the question, and Spencer and I kind of had this debate, but I was on my way home, so we couldn't really get into it too much. And I don't think we have the numbers. But, you know, so the insurance companies and whomever else are saying, okay, we have a third of the country, you know, who has BMI criteria for obesity. Now that doesn't even get into what is truly the disease of obesity, and that's excess or abnormally distributed adipose tissue causing harm. So people who are thinner with abdominal obesity, high cardiometabolic risk, they're not even qualifying anyways, but they might get it for diabetes. but let's just say a third of the country. So that is a lot of people. And let's just say we ultimately end up using one of these types of medications that is theoretically, or at least currently, still very expensive. And so at what point, you know, are we able to reconcile the money has to come from somewhere. So the cost has to be reduced by pharma. We have to quit wasting money by paying PBMs and then insurance. I don't know.
Explain the PBM thing? Just the general gist of it? You don't have to go into what is a PBM? Does anybody know what a PBM is? I don't really. I can't explain.
Pharmacy benefit managers. I think essentially.
Benefit manager. Yeah. I don't know. They somehow make money.
I think my understanding of it is either the health insurance company or it pays
makes deals
them
with these people
to
help
to keep their costs down for.
Yeah. It's a middleman.
For certain medications. So it's a middleman that actually, I think, makes healthcare more expensive all the
it
way
does.
Around. But.
They're so worthless.
I'll tell you what Wikipedia describes it as, if you want. It's a pharmacy. So pharmacy benefit manager is a third-party administrator of prescription drug programs for commercial health plans, self-insured employer plans, or Medicare Part D plans, or the federal employees, blah, 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 blah. So they're just this extra middleman that's causing problems.
It doesn't make any
Wikipedia
sense.
Has this whole business model thing on there too. We don't need to. People can just go and read about it. Whether we trust Wikipedia or not,
I don't think other countries have PBMs. I assume it's probably
it's a United States thing. It appears.
Yeah, of course it is.
Okay. We need to get a PBM person on here and grill them.
Let's. Then yeah, they need to be the president of some PBM. And it needs to be in person.
So three major PBMs, Express Scripts, CVS Health, and OptumRx of United Health Corp, comprise 78% of the market and cover 180 million enrollees.
Yeah. It seems like they simply exist just to restrict what patients are able to get access to and save money for
insurance companies.
Yeah, they're responsible for developing and maintaining the formulary, contracting with pharmacies, negotiating discounts. This is where I've heard from, like, even our pharma rep friends, is that these places are able to negotiate bundles and discounts and rebates, and it all sounds good. And then they have coupons for patients, which we all use, and that ultimately adds to the vicious cycle and drives up costs.
Yes, sometimes
over the place.
If they don't use their insurance, the price will be lower than if they were to use their insurance, which is insane.
That's absolutely insane. And all driving each other up in cost all over the place.
Yeah, because there's these online direct cost pharmacies now. There's a few of them that so many of my patients, not necessarily the weight-related drugs, but other options, they can order it for cash for 10% of what they're paying with their insurance.
Mark Cuban. Cuban's. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, like you said, these medications can be obtained in different countries for literally a quarter of the cost for these really expensive medications. It's still not cheap, but in the realm of some people
$100
might be able to afford it. Yeah.
$100, $200.
Yeah.
That's kind of the realm we're talking about. Like, there'd be people that would pay cash for that, and then other people, just have insurance. This stuff boggles my mind. It's really
very frustrating.
Yeah. I love that you brought up the body fat percentage and the true disease state of it, because that's another area that really I struggle with the insurance companies that were using the BMI criteria. And because of that, we're also using when they have requirements of percent body weight loss in order to stay on the medication, it's just one of those. It's just a poor representation of the disease state. When we have people that are really improving their body composition, inches around their waist improved, their quality of life is better. The food chatter in their head is turned off. And they get these significant benefits, but maybe they don't meet that percentage weight loss, and then the meds are taken away. So even the criteria that these insurers require to stay on the medication to determine success, like, how do we define success with these medications?
And, kind of ironically, so obviously most of the patients I see have fairly advanced, what I would call advanced stage of obesity. They do have a lot of complications. I see a lot of people with type 2 diabetes being an endocrine clinic and their heart disease and everything like that. So they almost always, we can get them one of these medications, right? Because they're indicated for type 2 diabetes, and they have, even though they're all working basically the same, right? It's just that there's a little bit more broader benefit for people with type 2 diabetes and heart disease. They garner a little bit more overall clinical benefit, but there's obviously no weight criteria for keeping them on them. In fact, there's really no criteria at all. I mean, even if it doesn't seem to be helping them glycemically, which they always do, but if they didn't, the insurance company wouldn't say, oh, it didn't work, stop it. I mean, they might. Sure. They seem to do that kind of stuff all the time. What they do is they change, and then we have to change their medication to something different. And that drives people nuts too. And by the way, I was going to ask you, so you talked about how you were on the phone. People don't realize how much time goes into all this stuff from their physicians. So you were talking about how you were spending time on the phone trying to help people by talking to their HR departments. And I wanted to ask you how the heck you have time to do that. I mean, because we're already working, 9-10 hour days trying to see patients in addition to the charting and all these other things and doing prior authorizations that we, or prescribe a medication, including the ones we're talking about. It's definitely indicated. The patient definitely should be on it and benefit from it. And then the insurance company says, well, hold on, are you sure? Then we have to go through and do the prior authorization, say, yes, I'm sure. So that takes up most of our time. I'm impressed that you have time to talk to HR departments. And so I hope patients, you know, we're not trying to put anybody on a guilt trip, but like appreciate Dr. Golden for her efforts, please.
Yeah, seriously.
I think they do. I don't have the time technically, but it's just a passion project, I think, more than anything. And, you know, I have a staff member that a good part of her role is working through the prior auths. And, you know, I've tried to make all kinds of template letters and for appeals to really simplify it for me as much as possible. But it's a significant investment for sure.
Yeah. For anybody listening, if you don't think doctors care about their patients, take a lesson from Dr. Golden. She's a beacon of light in terms of advocating for her patients. Thank you for discussing that, because it's good to show a good example. Anything else? I mean, we're at the 30-minute mark. We pretty much covered most of it, but if there's anything else, I think we kind of gave out our frustrations, and you're a good person to go talk about that.
You know, I think the only thing I'd share otherwise, because I'm very open with my patients about this as well too. And when I work with advocacy, you know, I'm also a person that lives with obesity. So, I feel this frustration on both sides of it. Mm-hmm. And, I know for me personally, when I would try to see if I could qualify for any of these medications a while ago, it was such a difficult task to try to achieve, even as a well-informed physician with all of physicians not really supporting it, not really understanding, not willing to go through the prior authorization process. And so definitely being able to experience that frustration on both sides of it. And maybe that's probably what motivates me to really put that extra effort in.
Wow. Well, thanks for sharing that too. Cause that's so, you know, people out there, we do know, we understand the frustration for the patients, and you know it from both sides. And it's very frustrating. It's so heartbreaking.
Advocating for yourself, advocating for your patients. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on, Dr. Golden. We may have to have you on in the future again, too, as these things develop.
Maybe when we get some people to put on the hot seat, we can be like Congress and start grilling them.
They're
just going to log off.
get someone to represent Big Pharma, get someone to represent insurance, Medicare.
We'll hear their little political answers that have been...
We'll get Bernie, practiced. we'll get somebody from the far right.
We'll have
a great debate.
Good Lord. All right. Well, thank you so much. Here's our outro. Give us a share. Give us some reviews. Whatever. I don't know. That's what everybody says at the end of podcasts.
Yeah. Let's do something.
Do something.
Help.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll